I'm going to do a brief review of what we did yesterday. So those of you who were here, you get to enjoy the movie again. This time, watch it with a little bit more awareness of what we talked about. And when I come back, we'll do a brief review for those who were not here yesterday, and we'll jump into the new material. Okay? And as I explained yesterday, I brought some friends with me to help me explain the idea of individual centers. Can you recognize this? I'm glad. These centers are demonstrated very well, I think, by the three characters in The Wizard of Oz, the Scarecrow, the Lion, and the Tin Man. I'm going to very briefly now run through the idea that in these motivational centers, each one of us has these, and they're operating all the time. But as people, we tend to prefer one more than the other. Problem is, not all of us prefer the same one. Some of us prefer to work with our gut center, our survival, our physical center. We tend to be in people's faces or confronting problems head on. Some of us tend to deal more with our head center, where we do a lot of thinking and analyzing, and we think before we act, perhaps. And some of us deal more with our heart center. We're very concerned with how people are feeling, how we feel about them, how they feel about us. So there's a relational center that's going on. The idea is that we have a preference for pleasure, and usually a preference to get away from pain. That's what we call motivation. It's what gets us moving in one direction and away from another direction. What this can lead to is an increase in self-esteem. Now, self-esteem is how we feel about ourselves. Do we feel confident? Do we feel aware? Do we like ourselves? Do we feel we're on the right track? This is when we tend to feel like we are centered. Self-esteem comes about when all three of the different centers come together and there's an overlap, where one center isn't over-dominating or overcompensating for one of the weaker centers. When that happens, we tend to be more interested in exploration and a little less interested in survival. Now, a head-centered person can be very interested in survival because what's at stake is their idea of themselves. A gut-centered person is very interested in their physical survival. I've got to somehow confront the world, create a space in it, because that's where I'm going to be, and I want to be safe. And an emotional-centered or a heart-centered person is going to try and create an emotional safety, emotional survival. They have to feel okay. They have to feel like whatever happens, they're going to come through it okay. Whether it's relating to you or me or the guy at the gas station. Something's going on. So when exploration becomes an interest, that's when curiosity gets piqued and the desire to become more self-aware kind of rears its little head like a little prairie dog out of its hole and looks around and says, what if? What am I doing? What is the world really like? Instead of, well, I just have to believe my perceptions. Because a perceived threat may not be a real threat. And that's what we're going to talk about. These are the centers. And I draw them in this unfocused... Is that better? Okay. The idea with the centers is that each one, you think of the large circle as you, and inside of you are these three circles. Now, these circles are, I think of them more as spheres, and there's an energy flow going between all of them. The idea is that one of those centers tends to dominate the way that you relate to others and to the world and in general. It's this imbalance that creates personality. That may sound a little strange. Some people say, well, are you born with a certain personality? And I say, I don't know. I can't get a lot of one-year-olds to talk to me. I can't get a lot of two-year-olds to talk to me about things I want them to tell me. But the idea is that in children, you can even see the dominant centers functioning. Now in Seattle, I'm a soccer coach for the last 2 years, 6, 7, and 8-year-olds. And I can tell my little gut kids because they're the ones that are charging ahead, scraping their knees, getting up, bouncing off each other, and running at the ball. And my little head-centered children are standing back a little bit, kind of watching what's going on, and getting an idea about where they should stand so they can become more effective. They're very good at setting up plays and giving the ball to the gut-centered kids so they don't get hurt. I can tell where they are. I always put them in the middle of the field. That way they know what's going on and can pass up and down. And the heart-centered kids are very concerned that everything's going all right with them. Okay? They want to feel like they're safe. But emotionally, if another kid falls down and gets hurt and starts to cry, they're the first ones there, offering assistance. Coach, coach, somebody's hurt. Okay, I'll be right there. And they're also the ones that are picking up the clover and looking at it as the ball goes by. Now, I can't tell you what personality type they are, but by watching their dominant centers, I can tell, in a classroom situation, for example, how these kids would learn. What sort of teaching style would they be most apt to learn from? So the idea of the centers is very important. Now, those of you who are here today and are head-centered people are going, this is very interesting information, and a lot of us just going, and you're saying, would you please get on with it? And the heart-centered people are going, do I like this guy or not? Is he warm? Is he friendly? Or is he just a lecturer? And the gut-centered people are going, geez, just turn the movie back on. Get on with it. Give me information. Just come on. Tell me what you want to tell me and get on with it. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to turn the movie back on. All you gut-centered people, relax. And we're going to see representatives of the different centers.
That's the trouble. I can't make up my mind. I haven't got a brain. Only stories.
How can you talk if you haven't got a brain?
I don't know. But some people without brains would not like talking, don't they?
Yes, I guess you're right.
Okay, that's the first center. Keep in mind who you think that might be. Any guesses? It's the second center.
My goodness, I can talk again. Oh, all my hands, please. All my elbows.
Did that hurt?
No, it feels wonderful. I've held that axe up for ages.
Goodness, how did you ever get my things?
Well, 1 year ago, chopping that tree, when suddenly it began to rain. And right in the middle of a chop, I rusted solid. I've been that way ever since.
Well, you're perfect now.
My neck. Perfect? Bang on my chest if you think I'm perfect. Go ahead, bang on it. Beautiful. What a nickel. forgot to give me a heart.
No heart?
No heart.
Okay, that's center number two. Now we'll watch the third center, and I think it'll all come clear.
Put him in! What are you afraid? I fight you about to get a floor. I fight you with one poor tie behind my back. I fight you standing on one foot. I fight you with my eyes closed. Oh, pulling an axe on me, eh? Sneaking up on me, eh?
Why? Here, go away and let us alone.
Oh, scared, huh? Afraid, huh? How long can you stay fresh in that can?
Oh.
Come on, get up and fight, you shivering junkyard. Put your hands up, you lopsided bag of hay.
Now that's getting personal, Lion.
Yes, get up and teach him a lesson.
Well, what's wrong with you teaching him? Well, I hardly know him.
I'll beat you in a happy week.
Okay, are there any questions? I hope so. Who do you think the Tin Man is? What center? The Tin Woodman.
Heart.
Heart center, I'm good. Then I'm teaching this right. Okay. How about the head center?
Straw man.
And the gut center?
Yeah.
Put him up, okay. Well, let's start with Mr. Lion. The gut center, and I'll just do this quick, is mostly relating to physical survival. I'm going to get through this somehow. I'm going to create my space. I'm going to confront the world. The world is my enemy, and I must somehow improve it or confront it or pull my arms and my legs into my shell and just survive against it. Okay, the gut center keeps us alive. The gut center is a lot like a little child in that it wants what it wants when it wants it. And it throws tantrums. It's the gut center that causes your arm to fly up suddenly on the freeway when somebody cuts you off. That doesn't happen to anybody, does it? Causing your horn to honk, it's like, I'm going to do this. And then you go, and then the head center goes, that wasn't such a good idea, was it? Okay. The need is for control, controlling the environment, controlling ourselves. Control seems to be what the gut center loves to do. Provide safety, physical gratification. I'm hungry, let's eat. I'm tired, let's sleep. I'm bored, let's do something. In fact, its communication style is just do it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to know how I feel about it. I don't care how you feel about it. Let's just do it. Let's get it done. I think the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, let's just call him the Lion, identifies the center very well, although he doesn't think he has any courage. But he's always the first one into the fray, even though the Scarecrow would like to be. The head center deals, like you might think, with conscious thinking. It's analytical. It compares things. Well, the last time this happened, I did this. Now, the next time this happens, I might do this. Where the gut center deals with what's happening right now, right in front of you, present time, the head center deals with what happened before and what might happen later. That's what the head center does. So it doesn't really understand present time very well. History books, the head loves history books because it can learn from what's happened before. It loves extrapolation. It can learn what might happen. So it kind of is a guidance system. In fact, its purpose is to guide and to educate, to reassure. It likes to plan and organize and do creative things. Communication style is, what if? What if this happens? What if this happened last time? What do I do? What is going on this time? And finally, as you might guess, the heart center is very concerned with relating. Feeling, approval. I want you to like me. As a presenter, if you don't like me, I'm not going to get very far. So I hope you like me. What I'm looking for is my guidance system. The emotional center tells us if we're on course. Its activities are compassion and sympathy. I'm relating to you as a human being. I have my flaws. I know you have your flaws. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just get together? A lot of emotion, a lot of feeling. Some people confuse feeling with thinking. How many people here have people ask them, how do you feel? Who's ever said that to you? This is very bad communication. Most people don't know how they feel. They can tell you how to fix a sandwich. They can tell you how to change your gas. They can tell you how to change a tire. But how do you feel? Well, feelings feeling this. This, you can give it a noun. I feel happy. I feel sad. So what do you feel? Might be a better way of saying it. How do you feel? I don't know how I feel. I just feel the way I feel. So that's just one little thing for improving communication. Ask people, what do you feel? Then you might get through this. Because how, the head goes, well, how? Well, first I start to feel this way. And then the explanations get started. Okay. That's right. All right. So in summary, the head, the centers look like this. This is just to give you an idea that they all work together. They all have very different functions to keep us alive. If it wasn't for the head center, we probably wouldn't know how to find what we want to eat. If it wasn't for the heart center, we wouldn't know how to express ourselves to other people. We wouldn't know how we feel. We wouldn't know if we're on course or if we're lost. And of course, without the gut center, we'd never do anything. We'd think about it, we'd wonder about it, we'd dream about it, but it wouldn't get accomplished. It's the interaction of all three centers that give us the ability to live as very potential developed human beings. Unfortunately, most of us stay asleep. Now, there are three states of being that I'm aware of. Only one of them I've experienced very rarely. The other two I experience almost daily. First is dreaming sleep, which you do laying down. The second is waking sleep, which you do right after you get up. When you get up in the morning, you immediately, usually, get into a routine. Go to the shower. I don't know about you, but for me, I take the soap and I start washing the same part. I can feel myself going through this routine, this automatic thing that I do. And then I say, okay, now I'm going to go down and go to the kitchen and turn on the coffee pot and do all this. And by the time I get to work, sometimes I don't know how I got there. I get in my car and I drive. How many people, when you're driving down the road, really think about driving when you're driving? I get in the car and I go, please start, please start, please start. And then I go back to sleep. Because the car's on, and I know how to get to work, and I just say, take me to work. And maybe I turn on the radio so I can have a little lullaby while I'm driving. And then I get to work, and I park the car, and then I become conscious because I have to look for a place to park. Okay, that's done. Now I go back to sleep. Walk to the elevator, go to my office, and there I am. And I can do my work asleep, and that shows. So there's sleepwalking, which is real dangerous. And if you try to come to the street and say to somebody, hey, how you doing today? They kind of jump. It's like, whoa, whoa. What you've done is you've woken up somebody who's sleepwalking. Okay? So be careful, especially if they're on a bridge. All right. Moving along into the Enneagram, you may have seen the symbol before. The symbol for the Enneagram is this really strange looking star. Now, I've had people come to me and say, this is satanic, right? This isn't Christian, this is the devil's work. I say, well, not really, it's more of a map. The lines identify the symbol. People say, oh, here's the Enneagram. And for those of you who don't know, the Enneagram means Ennea, which means nine in Greek, and gram means point. So it's just a nine-pointed figure. Behind the symbol, though, you can see the three centers operating. You have your heart center over here, and it includes these three points on the system. The gut center is at the top with the 8, 9, and the 1, and the head center off to the right with the 7, 6, and the 5. No one type is better than any other type. And surprise, all of these types are in you all of the time. They're all interacting. The reason that somebody who prefers this area can talk to somebody who's in this area is because you actually talk to that part of you comes out and communicates with that particular person. We're very adept at being able to relate to the other types, but sometimes it's not very easy because we have these pieces of ourselves, and some may be vestigially developed. They're not fully developed. Okay. I'm from Seattle, Washington. Originally, I'm from California. And where I was from originally, when people say, where are you from? I say, oh, I'm from California. I have a hard time. It's like, well, I live in Seattle, but I'm from this other place. When I came to Washington, I compared the things that I saw here to the things that I was accustomed to in the Bay Area. So when I came to Seattle, I said, aren't these bridges lovely? They're not really like the Golden Gate. They're not like the Bay Bridge, but they sure are interesting. The idea is that you will find, hopefully, by the end of this, not today, but during the week and during your own reflection, where you exist on the Enneagram. And I like to think of it as, this is probably maybe your hometown. So if you fall into the author's position, then when you experience other types, you will experience them from that position. you will relate to an inspector understanding it the way you do being an author. And the inspector will do the same thing. So we expect people to see the world the way we see it. And unfortunately, they don't. Not all the time. And occasionally you'll run into somebody and think, gosh, I have a lot in common with this person. I've never met them before, and yet I feel like I know them. Chances are you've run into somebody who shares your type preference. Now, this is different from the Myers-Briggs. There's no test to take. The only test you can take is where you go back over your own life and try to find some of the common denominators that identify you in one group as opposed to another. And there's no type that's better than any other, and I'm sorry about the inspectors if they think there might be better types. Very quickly, I'll go through here and talk about these different types. Now remember, the 8, 9, and the 1 prefer the gut center. They like to be moving against, ordering, structuring, and being safe. The champion, the number 8, identifies them as being, they say to themselves, I am powerful. That's their self-identity. Now this is very important because other people may see them as being bossy, as being overbearing, abrasive.
In your face.
All the time. But to the 8, they're just saying, I'm powerful. What are you going to do about it? One of their favorite expressions is, you can see it in children, make me. They love coming up against people in power and saying, oh yeah, what makes you think you're in charge? They like to debunk. They like to come up against authority and challenge it. That's what this champion 8 will do. If you can think of, I used the example of Clint Eastwood yesterday in the movies, of somebody who comes up against other people and says, well, do you feel lucky? Well, do you? And this is like this immediacy. I'm in your face and I'm going to be in control. I don't care what you think. I'm not interested in your feelings. But I know I have to be in charge and I'm going to use my head center next. Because remember, it's a dominant center that's taking control. The gut center is controlling it. But then the next center closest to the 8 is the head. So 8s tend to be least in contact with their feelings. It's hardest for them to express their sensitive side. And very easy for them to express this powerful side, this almost explosive gut energy. The negotiator 9, next to the 8, is equidistant between the two other centers. So the 9 tends to ride the fence, and even in the diagram, they're kind of at the top of the Enneagram. It's like, well, their expression is, I'm okay. That's their self-identity. I'm okay. The room's okay. Is everything okay? Are you okay? Okay? Okay. 9s like the word okay because they want it to be nice and smooth. They want it to be no conflict. Conflict really bothers them. And if there is conflict, they can tend to anesthetize themselves. They'll deny that there's any conflict. There's no conflict here. What do you mean? And things are exploding all around. Oh, that'll pass. It'll go away. Another phrase they use is, this too shall pass. 9s are very good at keeping on, keeping on. It's just, and if they get upset, what do? They're like a turtle. They pull their arms and legs in, and they sit in the middle of the road. They're not worried about what's going to happen to them because they know they're safe, as long as they don't have to interrelate and interact. It's very difficult sometimes to know what the 9 wants because sometimes the 9 doesn't even know what they want. The negotiator's very concerned that everything stays okay. So they like to go with the flow. Communing with nature is something that's very, very easy for the negotiator to do because it's very peaceful. And that's how they define themselves. I'm okay. I'm peaceful. The next gut center type is the 1, which is the inspector. Now the inspector, self-identity is I am hardworking, and they work hard. Of all of the types, the inspectors have the ability to stay up until 4 in the morning working on a project to make sure that it's done. They're very efficient, they like punctuality. Be punctual, be on time. Why? Because time is critical. You only have so much of it, and there's so much to do. So much to do, and you have to do it right. I don't know if you know anybody like that. But it says, hey, the harder I work, the more recognition I'll get, the more recognition I get, the harder I'll work. So what happens is, employers will say, hey, this person's really hardworking, and they'll get their work done in 3 hours. The employer says, here's more work. You're so good at this, here's some more. And the one says, good, if I prove that I'm hardworking, then I'll get more reward. And what they get is, more work. This is easy. This is great. But what drives the 1 is this attitude inside that I am hardworking and the need to impose order on a very chaotic world. 1s are responsible for a lot of our structure. I would even chance to say that The Catholic Church is a very one organization. We're going to organize this system of religion, and we're going to impose it. I mean, I look at things like the Crusades. I look at the Inquisition. If you don't agree with us, that's too bad. You must agree with us. We have the best way. Now, I'm not putting down the Catholics at all. I happen to even fall into that category. Now, there's a lot of guilt involved. We're taught it. We're taught it in the second grade. Self-effacing, things like that. But the idea of the rigidity sometimes can really affront people. Now, the eights will come up against authority, but the ones almost impose the authority. It's almost like the eights and the ones can tell if they're not getting along because ones want things done a certain way and the eights say why. Why do you think it should be this way? Not that the eights have a better way to offer, they're not exactly sure, but the one, the inspector, will say this is the way it ought to be done. Please do it this way. Sometimes they won't even say please. One thing you'll see in the inspector that's a real obvious sign to me is you'll ask them if they're angry. They look like there's something bothering them. The jaw will be set and say, geez, are you angry? And their eyes kind of get fiery, and they tense their jaw and they go, I'm not angry. And you go, well, you kind of seem angry, and meaning, I'm not angry. And it's like the more they're faced with this, the worse it gets until you think, oh, the veins start to pulse, and pretty soon it's going to be an explosion. And it is that they are angry. But because of their perspective, they think they're not supposed to have that feeling. That anger is not okay because you've got to be perfect. And being angry means that this is a very unordered feeling. This is a feeling that is very difficult to control. But the ones who learn to control it. So what gives them the intensity to pursue projects is the very thing they need to get in touch with so they can apply it in different areas of their life. To learn to say, yeah, I can leave this alone, it's good enough. They're very hard on themselves, much more so than any of the other types. The ones tend to be very critical, more of themselves, and then it eventually spreads out into the world. So they'll find some way to fix almost anything. If you put up a picture on the wall, and you invite the one in to say, come and look at this. The one will say, that's a really nice picture, and then go up and straighten it for you. And they think that's fine, because that's their perspective, is that things can always be a little bit straighter. They don't realize the wall's crooked, but moving on to the heart center, the assistant two, self-identity is, I'm helpful. I'm so helpful. I determine my personality, my perspective, my way of dealing with the world by what I can do for you. Don't worry about me. I'm fine. What can I do for you? I realize my leg's bleeding, but that's okay. I know I should see a doctor, but I'll see them later. What can I do for you? Twos are very warm and welcoming. And if they invite you into their home, it's going to be a very comfortable place to be, and they're going to make sure you feel right at home. Make yourself at home is a good two expression because they assist. I can tell sometimes on my soccer team where my little assistants are because they don't go for the goal themselves. They always kick it to the person. They don't try because they're not aware of their own needs. That's the trade-off for the two. Is it's easier for me to take care of you than it is for me to tell you what I want. Teresa is a very good example of a good two with self-esteem. I'm going to go help these people that need help, rather than stay here and help people that don't need as much help. And she's become a very good example of somebody who's given her life to help others. And in the scripture, Jesus says, there's nothing greater that you can do than to lay down your life for your friends. That should be written in a big banner and hung in every room as a two. That's their honest belief, that I will somehow be better if I help other people. And what the two has to learn is that they have needs too, and that those needs can be met. But they have to be willing to ask. They have to be willing to face the fact that somebody may say no. Someone may say, I can't help you. Because deep down, that's their fear, is that if they do present their need, and they lay their soul bare, that somebody will step on it. Oh, you don't need that. You're right, let me get you a cup of coffee. Now, you move around into the middle of the heart center and you have the administrator three. The administrator is very goal-oriented. they have an internal occupation that says, I will identify with what I am. If Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, the three said, I do what I am. I am what I do. I am my project. If the project fails, so do I. If the project succeeds, then I am a success. It's very difficult for them to separate the issue from the person. So they're very good. They get so emotionally involved in the project that people are drawn to what they're doing because they put so much energy into them, into this thing. Where the one would try to impose the order from without, from the outside, the three takes their inner order, which is their identifying with the project, and says, let's do it. Let's get this done. I'm excited about this. Look what we can do. Look what we can accomplish. But they sometimes forget to share the success with the people who have helped them because they identify so strongly with the success of what they do. They make very good salesmen. They're very good at telling you all the things there are about the product that you need to know so that they can be successful and sell it to you. The image of Lee Iacocca, it seems to be a three. Phil Donahue, anybody ever watch Donahue? It's even called The Phil Donahue Show. Okay. Although the camera is on the guests some of the time, most of the time, who's it on? It's on his face, too. It's not just on him. If he's not mixed into the audience, like, say, Arsenio Hall or Sally Jeter or Jesse Raphael. And I don't watch a lot of TV, but I've seen him a few times. But Phil really owns the camera, and it's his show. It's like Johnny Carson had The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson, not The Johnny Carson Show. So there's a difference in how these things happen. I'll move on to the four, the author. The four, author four, is a heart-centered person with a secondary head center, which means they tend to have a very difficult time expressing their feelings. They do a lot of internal rehearsing. And their phrase of identity is, I am unique. They're scared of being ordinary. They don't want to fit in. They like not fitting in. In fact, they look for ways not to fit in. If they feel like they're fitting in, they're going to do something so they don't fit in. So they make very good actors, actresses, artists, people who create something brand new, and yet they put a lot of themselves into this creation. The thing is that they're not really sure who they are. It's very difficult to express self-identity. So they say, well, I must be unique. If I'm like everybody else, it's just not enough for me. So in their head, they present this, they have this whole pageant going on about who they are and how they can be better people, and isn't it wonderful? And yet, on the outside, you don't see anything. The four might walk in the room and go, it's just so nice to be here. There's almost a sense that they're not connected the outside world sometimes. It's very difficult for them to come in and show you who they are because they're afraid that if they do, they'll just appear ordinary. So it's better to be safe and think they're ordinary than to express it and say, oh, I saw that last week. Oh, God, scurry out of the room. They are the most sensitive of all of the Enneagram types. They're very sensitive to the emotional state that people are in. They make very good counselors. They're very good listeners because they really believe that they've had the most trouble of anyone in the world. That they've suffered more turmoil and more pain and grief. No one can possibly have the kind of grief that I've had or the kind of joy that I've had. So your author fours will tend to have a really high emotional state and they're riding on top of this crest and in a phrase they can drop down into the depths of feeling.
Are they the most vulnerable?
They seem to be. All of the types are vulnerable in their own ways, but fours seem to have the least amount of protection. It's like when they suffer depression very heavily, and they suffer joy very heavily. So there's this roller coaster that they're on constantly. And the best time to catch them is when they're on the way up. Because when they're on the way down, they try to get away from people. They don't want to impose their feelings on others, and they get very frightened because their feelings are so, they almost collapse. They're not sure how their structure is. I almost compare fours sometimes to a whale. You don't see them very much. They're in the ocean. They come up for air once in a while, and then they go back down. And they go down deeper than any of us ever can go. And they bring these treasures back up, and they're almost mystical. Fours make good mystics because, number one, they tend to be introverted. They tend to want to be by themselves. And they tend to be very feeling. You're familiar with Myers-Briggs. And they're very big picture. They tend to want to see how things are overall, but they have a hard time telling you.
how they feel.
Poetry attracts forms. They can very much identify with the feelings that are being transmitted in a poem.
Musicians,
because then you don't even need words. I can just use my music. And especially when someone comes up and says, that made me feel so special or so different, then they feel like they've succeeded, and they'll, and inside there's this huge, yay! And outside they go, thank you. And they think that, you know, they've just expounded on to this whole thing about, oh, how wonderful my music was, and they go home and they have a little party with themselves. But they don't even have to, they don't even have to open a bottle of champagne. They just go home and go, oh, that was so nice. So there's a sense of understatement in a form personality in the author. Now, we'll kind of sweep over into the head center, and where the four is very good with emotion and feeling their emotion, not being able to identify it, but they have it. The stage five does it with their brain. They are the thinkers. They are the information gatherers. I'm going to take all this information in, and I'm going to define myself as I am knowing. Of course, I have the answer to that question. Now, whether or not I'll tell it to you, I don't know. Where the fours are stingy with their feelings, and there's this sense of pathos, the fives are very stingy with information. They read voraciously. The back of cereal boxes, the sides of gasoline cans, the New York Times, cookbooks, and they remember it all. It's all in this huge Library of Congress in their brains. The trouble is they're very reluctant to share it. Because if they share information, then somebody may say, well, what about, they may not know. They're scared to death that somebody's going to ask them a question they don't know. And if they do, they go, I'll get back to you on that. And then they go down to the library and they read 16 books and they come back and they give you a huge answer. Fives tend to give answers like nuggets. They're like a mountain of gold, and they say, well, here's an answer. Do you need one? Until you get them talking about a topic that they know a lot about. And then you better have your hip waders on, because it's going to get really deep. And they'll give you everything. And then they'll stand in front of you and go, there aren't any questions, are there? Of course they don't want to be asked anything. They've told you everything. They've given you the definitive answer. So please don't ask. Fives like observing. You can usually see them in coffee shops, in the corner, behind an espresso, if you have that stuff, and a book. And they're looking over the top of the book and they're watching everything that's going on. And they'll read for a few minutes and then they'll look up. And you think they're looking at you, but really what they're doing is sorting information and putting it in different categories in their mind. We talked yesterday about the reading process of fives, that it's like going to Disneyland for them. They open the book and everything starts happening. All this information starts being categorized and filed and put away. And if you interrupt them, they have to shut the whole process down and go, what? It's not that they're deaf, it's that they don't understand words when you're reading. They don't understand you. They're just like, who are you? They have to really, it's a big effort for them to come up out of that depth, that high head center with that feeling, because they feel like they own the information. Fives, very typically, when you tell them something confidentially, well, you've given them information, now it belongs to them. And it's not atypical for a sage five to accidentally tell somebody that information in the course of a conversation, not because they're trying to give away your confidence or blow your secret, but because they feel like they own the information. It's just information. So there's that sense of almost the absent-minded professor sometimes. They know so much, but they forget some of the obvious things. So the way they express themselves, they're very withdrawn for the most part. They prefer the observing part of themselves. They feel safe. Now, I mentioned Johnny Carson when I was talking about Phil Donahue. No, I mean to say, I forgot. An example of a four. How many saw Harry Met Sally? Anybody see that? Billy Crystal?
Harry Met Sally.
When Harry Met Sally? Meg Ryan is, of course, the inspector one who's doing everything precisely, mailing her letters one at a time to make sure everything's put together. Well, Billy Crystal practices his moaning. And he just has to practice because he wants the people to know how to say it. Meryl Streep plays a lot of four roles. I think Jackie Onassis fell into that category because she was just so effective. Everybody was drawn to her feelings during the whole thing with John F. Kennedy back in the 60s. And she became a very public figure, but she really didn't like it very much. Fours tend to be very private. Fives, and I'll say Johnny Carson, because if you'll notice what he did on his show when he was still on, Johnny sat behind a desk. And the camera was usually on his guests, and the guests were always exposed. There was nothing in front of the guests, just their legs. And Johnny would sit there with his pencil, and he would ask questions. So he was there as the observer with this desk, this barrier between him and the audience and the guests. He was safe. And he had more information, and he knew what questions to ask to get his guests to talk, and that's why his show was so successful. As opposed to, say, Arsenio Hall, who is not a five, who tends to have the show wrapped around him, and he doesn't ask very good questions. He's not an excellent interviewer, if you've seen that show. I'll move on to the six. The facilitator six appears to be the most nervous of all the types. They're always looking over their shoulder. They seem to be more worried about what's happening in the big picture than anybody else. But what's happening with them is that they're very alert. They're very aware of what's going on in the environment, because what's important to the six, or to the facilitator, is how's the group doing? How am I doing in the group? Are we all okay? Now, this sounds a lot like that heart-centered assistant, but the assistant is concerned with you as an individual. Assistant wants to say, how are you doing? And the facilitator says, how are we doing? Is everybody having a good time today? Everybody like breakfast this morning? Are we doing good? The two is going to say, what did you have for breakfast? Did you like it? Because there's that one-on-one with the heart. But for this particular head center, the six, they're concerned with how everything's going. And they manage to keep everything afloat. Fives kind of keep things in boxes, and they open up the boxes individually. But the sixes manage to juggle, and they keep a lot of stuff up in the air. The problem comes when they start doing too much. And they do tend to overextend themselves because there's so much to be done and so many people to take care of inside the group. The Japanese culture, to go on a limb here, seems to be a very six-oriented culture. Everybody is talking to everybody else and exchanging information. And no one makes a decision by themselves. It's not heard of. It's not part of their background. They tend to share all of this information. So I used yesterday the example of Luke Skywalker in Star Wars. Luke doesn't want to be a hero. He wants to join the Rebel Alliance. He wants to be part of this large group that's doing something. He doesn't know what he wants to do. He wants to be a pilot. But he's not sure about anything else except, I want to be part of a big group that's doing something. I don't want to be stuck on this backwards planet by myself. Sixes like to be part of groups. That's where they feel the best. So the facilitators make very good office managers. They're very aware of the phone system and the mail system and this department and that department and human resources and the whole thing, and they're very good at keeping it all in front of them. What'll usually happen, though, is somebody will toss them a bone. They're juggling balls, and somebody will toss them like a shoe. They're not sure how to continue doing it, and it'll all fall down. Then they get real scared because they think the whole group depends on them to do their job. Oh, everybody's depending on me. So there's this sense of, I can't deviate from the group. I've got to do it. I've got to get it all happening again. And they get frantic, and people think, why don't you just relax? So they always seem like they're on the edge. They're always looking for that shoe to come in from the side. So just in case they have to juggle it, they can. They define themselves as being, I am loyal. They get their authority from the consensus. Well, that's the law. That's why we have to do it this way. You can't jaywalk because it's against the law. The law is everybody. However, if a group of people are jaywalking across the street against the light, and the facilitator is the last person in the group and going, well, everybody else is doing it. And they get tapped on the shoulder by the policeman.
Excuse me, I'm giving you a ticket for jaywalking.
And the facilitator looks up and says, well, everybody else is doing it. Why don't you give them all tickets too? It's hard for them to take personal responsibility for what they do because they identify so much with the group. Now, for young people, especially in middle school and high school, there's a tendency to want to be part of this group for survival. Okay, the whole gang phenomenon seems to be driven by the desire to fit in. I'm not saying that all children are sixes. It's just that it's very easy for children and young people who are in that particular style to fall into any kind of group that will support and sustain them. So theater is a really wonderful place for fours. What are the sixes going to do? How are they going to find in? How are they going to fit in? What are they going to do? So when they get out of school, they'll tend to join large companies and be part of big organizations. They may even come from big families. They're so identified with group structure because they think all of their power, everything out here, is what they have to control. And they have very little self-confidence inside that says, hey, I don't have to worry about what's happening out in the world. I'm going to be okay. But this inner strength, and then they can take control of their sphere of influence. And Steve Covey, who's done some management work, has come up with this idea that you have a sphere of influence, things that you actually have control over. And then there's the circle of concern. The circle of concern is usually much bigger than you. I can't do anything about what's happening in Bosnia, but I can make sure I get my laundry washed today. Okay, there's the things that we can control, and then we can extend our circle of influence once we have self-confidence and self-esteem. Otherwise, we can become over-concerned with things we have no power over, and the facilitator tends to do that. They want the group to be okay. They can extend the group to be the entire world, and then they're carrying a lot on their shoulders. Moving over to the Optimist 7, how many people here saw The Sound of Music? Right. Maria von Trapp in The Sound of Music seems to play, Julie Andrews plays this really wonderful, optimistic seven. The seven defines themselves as, I am joyful, I am delightful, I am fun, I am nice, I am ready to go. And they're very enthusiastic people, they're very good with ideas. They love to tell stories, they like being around children, but they don't like pain very much. They're really good at starting an idea, oh, this is a great thing, let's get this going. They better have a one to hand it to. Because the one will get it done. The seven is very bad with follow through because they start one project and that gets them, oh, I didn't notice this before. And so suddenly their focus shifts and they're on this now and this isn't getting anywhere. So if you go to their house, you usually see books that have bookmarkers halfway through. You'll see dishes that haven't been done. Maybe the trash should have been taken out because what is that smell? Oh, there's nothing to eat. Well, I'll order a pizza because I forgot to go to the grocery store. Sevens are really good at doing new things. And because they like to do so much, they're called the gluttons of the Enneagram. Because they love to do so much. If once is good, twice must be great. And if I like it again, well, I might do it for a week. Oh, never mind the laundry. I'll get to that one. Oh, I forgot to pick the kids up at school. Oh, well, they'll wait for me. The Optimist Sevens really think that there's enough time to do everything. And so they don't get enough sleep because there's just so much to do and there's so much they want to do that time gets away from them. Time gets away from them very easily. Each one of the types experiences time a little bit differently. For ones, there's not enough. For sevens, there's more than enough. They always think there's plenty of time, so it's not unusual to find them less than punctual. Oh, I'm only a half hour late. What's the big deal? Come on, let's go to the movies. And they have a way of turning people who are really angry at them, kind of making them laugh and go on. They've got a charm. Threes are charming too, but they're charming because they want you to do something for them. Sevens are charming just because they like you. That's their nature. In family of origin studies, the seven tends to be the jester, the joker, the dreamer, the one that says, oh, come on, we can go do this. Always looking at the cloud behind, or the silver lining behind the cloud. To go along with the joke about the ponies and the manure, it's the seven in the pile going, in the middle of all this, there's got to be a pony. And you'll experience this if you do garbology at any time this week. Recycling was not developed by sevens, but they get into it, literally. Ah, oh, look at this, I wonder what that was. Nobody else would go near it, but you know, there's this curiosity, there's a playfulness in the seven that a lot of people are attracted to. And again, it's in everyone, but in sevens it's almost developed too much. They tend to depend on it, and it's like, well, you know, I'm really sorry that your father died, but let's go out, let's go to the movies, let's go do something else so we don't have to stay here and deal with this problem. They don't like problems. It's not that they don't like conflict. They love to get into an argument. They'll take both sides of an argument. Because it's a game. It's fun. It's something to do. Oh, okay, great. You're going to shoot me. Now let's trade guns. Quick, is it? Bugs Bunny, I don't know exactly what type you'd call him, but he has a lot of seven in him because he's always got these ideas about things that he can do. And he's always foiling people by doing the unexpected. Sevens are very good at doing the unexpected. Julie Andrews gets kicked out of the Abbey. She's got no home. She's going to go live with this one who's got seven children. Okay, the one because he goes to bed with a tie on and he has a whistle for all of his kids. And they're very strict and straightforward. Well, she goes to do this and she says, I got confidence in sunshine. And she's dancing down the streets of Vienna and I'm thinking, okay. And then she gets there and she gets into the argument with the captain and all this is happening and children are scared and they're in the room. And she's just been chewed out. Her rear end still hurts.
And she says, I know.
I'll make play clothes out of drapes. The idea with the seven is that there's life is a fun thing to do, and don't get worried about the pain. You know, okay, so I didn't do what he wanted to do. Well, that's his problem, not mine. And really, it is hers, and it gets her into more trouble later on when the captain comes back. The kids are playing in the trees, and he's worried about his reputation, how he looks to the community, how the children are going to look to the community. And she's worried about these kids having childhood and having fun. Even to the puppet show. I mean, all the things that go on in that movie. It's a very good example. Let's see. I'm almost out of time. I'm going to show you another scene in the movie, if that's okay. Maybe tired of hearing me talk for a while. Two scenes here. The first one is The Wizard of Oz. And the thing is, they have just taken care of the witch.
Not so fast! Not so fast! I'll have to give the matter a little thought. Go in and come back tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Oh, but I want to go home now!
You've had plenty of time already.
Yeah! Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz! I said come back tomorrow!
If you are really great and powerful, you'll keep your promises!
Do you presume to criticize the great Oz? You ungrateful creatures! Think yourselves lucky that I'm giving you audience tomorrow instead of 20 years from now!
Oh.
The great Oz has spoken!
Oh.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain! Yes. The greatest Oz!
Who are you?
Oh, I am the great and powerful Wizard of Oz.
You are? I don't believe you.
No, I'm afraid it's true. There's no other wizard except me.
You humbug!
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly so.
Okay. The point in this scene, and we were quiet about it before, is that this is an example of what happens when the three centers operate together. In the whole story, they've been separate people. When they're running across the field of poppies, first they're linked arm in arm and they're going through the forest, and then they separate. They all take off as individuals. The centers are basically out of control. They're not unison. So they fall apart. The lion goes, and he's down. So the gut center is out of the picture. The heart center freezes, paralyzed by fear of tragedy. Oh my God, this is him. This is the Wicked Witch. And he starts to cry and he freezes. And the scarecrow is like jumping around, doesn't know what to do. So he starts yelling for help. And that's all he knows how to do. It's like all the centers are completely polarized. They're all over the place. And in this scene, after they've managed to rescue Dorothy, and they're basically Dorothy's centers that have come together, they have the power to confront the wizard and to unmask him. So each one of the centers is very strongly themselves. Dorothy has become more integrated. Now who here wants to posit an idea of which center or which type she may be? Think of what she does throughout the story. I think she's a two. I think she's an assistant. She's very worried about these individuals. But really, she just wants to go home. And even at home, at the farm at the beginning of the movie, she's taking care of everybody. She's got a lot of different qualities in her. It's kind of hard to put her together because the movie's really about the different centers coming together. But she seems to be very heart-oriented. She's very, very caring. She doesn't spend a lot of time analyzing, but she frees the scarecrow from his perch. She oils the Tin Woodsman. She frees up her emotions. And then she tames the gut center. She gives him courage. I mean, all of this happens at once inside the movie. I'm going to give you one more example, and then set you free for lunch. This is from the Dead Poets Society.
Words and ideas can change the world. I see that look in Mr. Pitt's eye. Like 19th century literature has nothing to do with going to business school or medical school. Right? Maybe. Mr. Hopkins, you may agree with him thinking, yes, we should simply study our Mr. Pritchard and learn our rhyme and meter and go quietly about the business of achieving other ambitions. A little secret for you. Huddle up. Huddle up! We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. The medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for.
Okay. This is a more telling example of integration than even Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. Robin Williams, from watching this movie, seems to be
a seven
who has gotten himself together. The way that he teaches the kids, his ability, he cares about what he's teaching. He really believes, and this is heart-centered. The head doesn't believe, the head agrees. But the heart-center is where we get our beliefs, what we really truly value, what's important to us. So Robin Williams, as John Keating, really believes what he's telling these kids. And he has a way of teaching them, because he's very knowledgeable, he knows his subject, he knows all about it. But he gets them moving. He uses that gut center to pull them into a huddle, and he can talk like this and keep their attention. I'm going to conclude this with a quote. It's from Robert Moore and Douglas Gillette, from a book called The King, Warrior, Magician, Lover. It's a book about male psychology, about growth and awareness. And this deals both with men and women in this paragraph, so don't feel excluded. It says, the conclusion of both modern physics and depth psychology is that things are not what they seem. What we experience as normal reality about ourselves and nature is only the tip of an iceberg that arises out of an unfathomable abyss. Knowledge of this hidden realm is the province of the magician, and it is through the magician energy that we will come to understand our lives with a degree of profundity not dreamed of for at least 1,000 years of Western history. Mm-hmm. And I want to leave you today with the idea that as you're spending the rest of your day, whether you're out and walking to Holden Lake or going down and playing pool or just going back to your rooms, think about yourselves and which center might be the most dominant center for you. And there's no center any better than any other. But we're